In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Hey everyone, Yas here, and I just wanted to say it's great to have you join me today because I'm sure we're going to have another fantastic episode. So whether you're here for the first time or if you're one of the repeat loyal listeners of the show, I truly appreciate you. But before we get to today's guest, I just have a small favor to ask, and that's if you could just take a brief moment to hit the subscribe button if you haven't already. Ensure that you share it with all your coaching friends, and don't forget to get in touch, guys. Let me know your thoughts on what you think of today's episode or any of the recent episodes you've listened to. You can do this on Twitter at The Coaches Net. Once again, that's at The Coaches Net. And please make sure you do, as I'd love to hear your thoughts, guys. Anyway, on to today's show. I hope you enjoy it. Have a great day, guys.
The Coaches Network.
Hey, guys. You're now listening to The Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy. Right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name is Coach Yas, and I'm a very special guest for me today. My guest today is Jake Lister. Good afternoon, Jake. How's it going, man?
Hi, mate. Thank you very much for having me. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so it's always a pleasure to be on and to chat with you.
Awesome. Jake, just for those that maybe aren't familiar with yourself, a bit of background around who you are, what you do, and we'll go from there.
Yes, so I'm a coach developer with the Football Association. Been doing that for about 3 years. And then I've just started a new role at Sheffield United Women as their youth pathway lead, which is like the head of coaching, but in charge of developing the coaches, but leading the ETC program as well as coaching with under 21. So it's all encompassing, but it's good, should be good.
Awesome. Just take me back a little bit further than Jake. So, you know, where did your journey start? And you mentioned there about coach development 3 years in. Obviously, you started as a coach. What was that like? And, you know, how did you come across that?
So my coaching journey started with my mum, to be honest. She was very, like, doing dance classes, after-school clubs, coaching different sports. I think she's coached every sport, every invasion sport you can think of, hockey, basketball, football, all of them. And my childhood really was doing all these activities with her and following around all these after-school clubs and extra sessions and stuff. So one, it got me well-versed in sport and got me really well into it. And then as I got older and saw the fun and enjoyment she spread with her sessions and the engagement she got, it just felt a natural progression for me to follow that pathway just because I'd seen her role model it for so long. And obviously I was into football as a kid, so like played grassroots and stuff. So joining them two worlds together just meant football coaching was my thing. So yeah, I started coaching in schools at university. So alongside university, sorry, coaching in schools and then grassroots clubs and getting as much experience as possible with different age groups and then like a Saturday morning club. And then I got an opportunity at a Category 3 academy with some really good coaches and a fantastic head of coaching that set me up on a development pathway so I could work with elite players, and then got picked up by moved along to a Category 1 academy. Did that for 2 years, which was fantastic. You know, the Disneyland of football, really, in that it had everything you needed. Or everything the players needed. But that environment exposed me quite a lot with my coaching. So I left that environment and went and did a master's degree at Leeds Beckett, which was fantastic for plugging a lot of them gaps. And then really since the master's degree or midway through the master's degree, started doing the coach development stuff with the FA. And then all them gaps seemed to be getting filled up and all this information started to come across or started to be applied, sorry, from the master's degree. So then that's just taken me to where I am now, which is working with the women at Sheffield United, and then doing the coach development stuff, and then doing bits and bobs on LinkedIn. So it's seems like a really linear journey, but not so lots of ups and downs and learning and experiences. But it's been one I wouldn't swap.
Just thinking about where to dive into the Jake. There's so many different aspects, and I think, you know, first and foremost, it's probably not a traditional journey in the fact that, you know, your mum was your inspiration to go into coaching.
Yeah,
which I don't think is the case for many of us. Certainly I've never heard that story before as well, so, you know, it's a unique bit there already. But I guess, you know, let's talk about, you know, how long you've been coaching now.
Started in 2014 with my level one, so what's that, 11 years.
Cool. So let's explore that then. So, you know, it's been a lot of I guess a lot of changes from probably when you started to where you are now, and obviously being part of the other side of the equation in terms of the coach education pathway. Mm-hmm. And what are some of the biggest changes that you've observed, and, you know, what are your thoughts on the current state of affairs with coach development and coach education across the board?
Well, my level one and my level two was delivered by the same person, a coach developer called Steve Lister. There's no relation, even though I tried to make it so to pass the course, but there wasn't any relation. And it was very much around pictures, setting up the pictures, not recreating pictures, but like stopping, starting as much as possible. So as soon as you see, and it was usually a mistake, and it was probably mistake led. As soon as you see a mistake, stop the practice, coach the practice or coach the player, and then carry on again. And one thing that stuck in my mind, because me and my mate did our level twos at the same time, he was buzzing after for his assessment because he stopped it 20 times. And he's like, oh, I stopped it 20 times in 15 minutes. I've smashed it. And I remember at the time being a little bit like envious that he'd stopped it 20 times. But then obviously as we've progressed, we've seen that like that's probably not the best way to do it. So as it's evolved, like the ePPP came in place in like 2012. So like the ripple effects of that, and how that's, and how the investment into coach education's come to a place where they're borrowing a lot from more like teaching circles and cognitive psychology places and motivational concepts and all these things from probably different universities and researchers. And I think that's what's evolved the courses. So now the UEFA C now is very, very much like representative game design, using the practice spectrum, and all them sort of concepts are drip feeding in, which is good, which is making coaching more effective for the context where the coaches are in.
It's quite interesting, because obviously, you know, that probably was the perception for many back in the day, you know, in terms of, you know, let's get in there, let's stop the session. Like you said, often mistake led. I think it probably took a lot of courage back then, in particular in those times, to maybe go in and stop something that wasn't a mistake, and, you know, highlight and reinforce some positive action, if you like. But it is, I think it is a I guess, not just indicative of the time that we were in back then, but also now, where a lot of coaches do necessarily gravitate towards the mistakes. So I guess, you know, in terms of that, you know, what are some of the biggest observations you've seen for coaches coming through the pathway now, in terms of your experience from a coach developer's standpoint?
I think one of the, I won't call it a major shift, but one thing I've probably noticed a lot more is kids, young adults coming out of university spaces. So doing a BTEC level three in sport, use it like a club or like a satellite hub. So one that's not like a traditional college. And then going into university and doing sports coaching courses, and maybe not getting as much experience in coaching, but their knowledge of coaching is a lot higher than probably traditional is the wrong word, but someone 10, 20 years ago, or more 20 years ago, where they just jump into coaching or they come from it from a different background. So a lot more, but it feels like there's a lot more theory coaches, a lot of like, here's my philosophy, here are my principles, here are the things that I want to implement as a coach. And a lot of coaches or young coaches who can back up what they're doing on theory, excuse me, and not really experience-led, more theory-led. So then the level two courses are not all participants, but a lot of participants, you're trying to buy them in or put these things across through experience and get them to learn and fail and reflect in a useful way, you know, to upskill them instead of just giving them more theory and things they can walk away with, if that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. It's just part of giving them that experiential learning, right? Where, you know, I don't know if you found this as well, but especially right now in the current climate, where you've got a lot of coaches coming through. Historically, obviously, level one would have been a face-to-face practical coaching course, get a bit of an observation, a bit of feedback around your delivery and some things to go away and think about. But there's also that opportunity of getting hands-on experience at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas that might not necessarily be the case now. Nowadays, you've got, you know, I've certainly come across a fair share of coaches who've done an online level one, and sometimes going on to UEFA C, which is the next step, is really, for some of them, it's the first time they're ever stepping foot on a grass to think about coaching a session. You know, so that jump is obviously massive, and that gap in their learning is probably there. And it's not to say there's a right or wrong, but it's just we're in a different time, I guess, more than anything else. But I find it quite interesting that you need to talk there about almost intentionally providing opportunities for coaches to learn through maybe failing at times as well. I guess, you know, what are you finding currently is the biggest challenge for you within that respect? Because, you know, I've been doing coach education probably close to 10 years now, just shy of 10 years, and I've seen the evolving from the old level one, level two, and, you know, obviously to what is now the UEFA C, and currently working across the, you know, the B and other bits around it. But it'd be interesting to get your thoughts on what you find the biggest challenges are for you from a coach developer standpoint, but also maybe put yourself in the shoes of the coaches that are on the courses themselves, and maybe share some insight on what you think the biggest challenges are for them.
Yeah, I think there's loads of points in that, but the one that sticks out the most with the level one, and I think this is starting to become a reflection on education as a whole, is that it's moving more online, probably because of COVID, but it's moving more online. It feels like this should be an FA level 1.5, which is like, you've passed the course, you've got the information, now go and deliver it and reflect on it and show us where you're at in terms of your delivery and your practice design and all these things. And then that becomes a bridge for the level two, or the UFC, sorry. So then we can get more, and I know it's tough because coaching isn't this, but you can get a little bit more standardization for the coaches who are coming on the course. So then the difference isn't as big. I know that's a tough ask, but it adds a more challenge for the coach developers, in a sense that exactly what you're saying, you could have a coach who's been working in grassroots for 20, 30 years with his grassroots club, and is confident on delivery but just needs a few tweaks. Or you could have someone who's coming on the course who's never coached before, done the level one online, and is starting with a grassroots club that year. So the difference is massive. And have we got the time, resource, and the time resource to impact everyone in them 3 weekends or 3 modules? Mm. It's a tough ask, but like experienced coach developers like yourself, it's something to consider on every single course. What was your other question? Sorry, that was the one in the front of your mind.
At the biggest challenges, you know, if you put yourself in the shoes of the coach now, you know, I guess some of the stuff you talked about there, really just touching on it a little bit, but, you know, what would you say the biggest challenges are? And I'd be interested to get your thoughts on
I think if I was a coach now in that position, I would go out and go and coach as many things as possible, and not just football. So, what the luxury I had was I was working with a company that did multi-sport, so I never coached football with them. So it was dance, then it was basketball, then it was gymnastics, then it was dodgeball, then it was all these other things. So then you're honing your skills on like how to engage kids through your practice design and your coach behavior. So it's like it's being thrown into the deep end and coming up with with strategies to adapt and thrive and survive in them environments. So what I would say for coaches in that space would be go and volunteer and coach in as many environments as possible. Go and find out what you don't know. Then you're at a point where you can start to explore and look for knowledge and then go and apply it, get it wrong, reflect, and just keep that process going of application, reflection, and exploration. Go and explore, find out what you don't know, go and apply it, reflect on it, and keep that cycle going, because you've got to really push yourself to what you don't know and just keep pushing yourself to try different things. Because you'll build these, and I'm sure you'll have got it even as a coach developer, these unconscious habits to just manage and facilitate a session. You'll know where to branch off when it's going right. You'll know where to branch off when it's going wrong unconsciously. And you just do it. That's what it feels like. You just do it. So then as a young coach, you need to put yourself in them positions, not even a young coach, an inexperienced coach. You need to put yourself in them positions to build them habits to facilitate and manage sessions in a number of different situations.
Yeah, I think it's spot on. And, you know, just thinking about what you're saying and you're talking there, and it takes me to like different profiles of learners that, you know, that I've come across. And, you know, you get those as you quite rightly touched on there, you know, never experienced it. The others on the other end of the spectrum, 15, 20 years into it, but maybe just haven't really gone intentional with the coach development aspect in terms of formal qualifications. And you've got obviously those guys anywhere and anywhere, everywhere in between. I think, you know, one of the things I've often noticed as well, and coming back to what you were saying about going out and finding what you don't know, I think it's a tough one, isn't it? Especially in I guess, in the game today, because I remember when I started coaching 15 years ago, there wasn't really, it wasn't seen as a career. It was something that you did because you were passionate about the game, and, you know, I guess your playing wasn't really going to take you anywhere. Or on the flip side, you just stop. You come to the back end of your playing journey, and you thought, right, I want to stay involved in the game. What's the best way to do it? Move into coaching. So a lot of people, and probably still now the case, probably more so before than now, rather. I'd say it was built around voluntary experiences. Mm-hmm. You go out and get your voluntary experience. Whereas, you know, on the flip side now, fast forward 15, 20 years, people are leaving school with the intention of becoming football coaches. Mm-hmm. You know, attending full-on three-year degrees, master's degrees, and all the other stuff with it. Coming out, like, with, you know, what you said there around all the theoretical knowledge around it, but maybe not the application and practical experiences. So I think, you know, what it is the challenge for certainly for coaches who are in those spaces there as well, that recognize, well, what is it that I don't know? And I think, you know, it's probably not been helped by the fact there's a massive rise in the number of coaches doing one-to-one type work, where it's this, you know, seen as a, right, I'm going to create a business out of this, but okay, fine. But that business that you're creating, what, you know, that's it might be fruitful for now, but is it going to keep being fruitful if you're not, I guess, working on your education as a coach and your development as a coach? And, you know, one of the things I've noticed with a lot of coaches working in grassroots football, especially now, more so with the UEFA C having replaced the old FA Level 2, is I think there's this unspoken perception that now it's a UEFA C, UEFA ratified qualification, not just an FA Level 2, that it's just become another marketing tool. And in addition to that, what tends to happen now, because of the perception of it being a UEFA qualification, it almost is now where any coaches that are doing those qualifications in their environments, they're probably seen as, in many respects, the smartest ones in the room, because they're progressing down that pathway. And I think one of the traps that puts them into is that if they're seen as the smartest one in the room, there's probably no one really challenging them internally, challenging them around what coaching looks like, or why they're doing what they're doing in the way that they're doing it, which then, you know, if that coach isn't being guided, it hasn't been effectively supported and mentored in whichever capacity that looks like, it probably creates quite a dangerous dynamic in that, you know, you almost get the blind leading the blind.
Yeah, I think you raise a really interesting point in that it's really easy in coaching, and it's happened to me a couple of times, where you're in an environment and you're sort of reaching the top of the environment. It's not the right thing, but you find a groove and you build habits where you are constantly getting it to a place where it's okay or it's good. It's like the okay trap. So like, because you're doing okay every week or every session or every game, or you start winning a few games, you start thinking that like you're the best coach in the world. But then, and this is what happened to me. So as soon as you step out of that environment, so category three, where I was doing okay for a season or two and I felt like I was a good coach and all these things, you step into a different environment where the challenges are different. That could be a different age group. That could be a different academy. That could be a different environment altogether, working with girls instead of boys. All these gaps, all these knowledge gaps will just pop up. Now, this is the thing where in your coaching, you can either go one or two ways, where you can either carry on and be really brave to push on and learn and keep applying and keep reflecting and keep going after it, if that's something you really want to do. Or you retreat back to the environment you're in, keep being the best coach at the environment you're in, and that'll be your coaching journey until you stop. I think there's that phrase where, have you coached the same year 20 times, or have you had 20 different years as a coach? Something along that sense. But you see coaches who have done that on the UEFA C, in that they've been a grassroots coach. Maybe they took the son from under nines to under 18s, and they're in their little village, got all the best players in the village. They win the league every year, or they've taken from the D division to the A division, or they've won a few cups, or whatever that looks like.
Mm.
And then they come onto the course, and this isn't a disrespect, but they come on with a
it's an ego, isn't it?
Yeah, an ego of like, yeah, geez, I just need this course. It's like it is what it is. and there's a little bit of like going against it, where you're like, are you accepting the learning and taking it on and willing to get better, or you're happy being in this okay trap? Which is fine. There's no mark on from any developer I've met where it's like, that's fine. If you just want to be here and get the badge, be here and get the badge, that's fine. If you really want to get better, then you need to challenge and push yourself. But you also make a great point on the, and it's something I've thought about for ages, and I wish it was something that someone told me when I first started coaching, is that coaching isn't a recognised profession.
Mm.
Not in that there isn't many coaches who have been working full-time in one singular environment or in a space and had, how could you say it, and had a normal, if that's the right word, normal life around it. What I mean by that is, an electrician or a plumber goes to work 9 till 5 or whatever they do, comes home, has got that family dynamic, got the social time, got the weekends, all that sort of stuff. A coach, if they want to work full time, has to work Saturday, Sunday, evenings, and then is scratching their head in the day going, am I going to make any money? And that's why, and I get it, it's an unsociable job, in that like, the people you need in your session are doing other things in the day.
Yes.
For obvious reasons. And I think COVID really exposed that for me, in that like, we were the first people, one of the first group off and one of the last group back. So it was a feeling of, are we really key in this, not world, because that's too deep, in this economy? Sort of a sense, like, is this job a must have, or is it a we all like to have? And it brings up some interesting dynamics on how you think about your role as a coach, because you think it's so important.
You know, I'd probably say that, you know, this, you know, it's quite interesting what you're saying then. I think, it probably is that the role is really important, but not for the things what a lot that a lot of people attach it to.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. You summarised it better than I could.
But it's quite interesting because, you know, one of the things that you talked there about, you know, coaches who are basically moving into an environment where they almost to some extent start to feel a bit uncomfortable and try and gravitate towards back to that comfort zone, right? And I think we talk about it all the time, right? The, you know, being uncomfortable is probably where you're going to get your stretch, challenge, and your growth. And, you know, one of the things I often see is, and I've always thought about doing this, like from my own perspective, and I don't know whether that was fortunate, lucky, or someone dropped a message in, and I can't remember who it was, but it was literally, you know, just put yourself in a situation where you're constantly going to be challenged. Give yourself enough time to, you know, enjoy the challenge, enjoy the successes of overcoming the challenges when you do, but, you know, never rest in that respect. You know, you've got what's next, you know, and as time goes on, it's that old adage of, you know, the more you find out about what you know, the more you realize you don't know anything.
Yeah, 100%. And it's something you've got to do it. Otherwise, you like exactly what you're saying, you'll never progress if you're just standing still. So it's always, you know, what's next? Can I push myself and post on LinkedIn? Can I push myself and go and work with the 21s or the first team or whatever it is? You've always got to be looking for that next goal and the next achievement.
So just, you know, just thinking about what you said there, you know, about coaching, not necessarily being recognised profession, but I think, you know, I'm assuming now, and let me speak for you, but agreeing that maybe coaches are getting younger and younger in terms of their inception into the world of coaching.
Mm.
You think there's coaches who are starting out young that are missing a trick by starting too early and not just spending time experiencing the game, so to speak?
I think if I was planning the perfect coach journey for somebody would be when you leave school or 16 and leave school, it would be to carry on playing at the highest level you can, whether that's five-a-side or semi-pro or professional, whatever it is. Carry on playing. Do a little bit of coaching on the side. And then, so I'm talking about, this could be probably a semi-pro player. So you're playing semi-professional, you're training through the week, you're doing a little bit of coaching, and then you've got another job on the side, whether that's whatever, apprenticeship, plumbing, whatever it is. Just because the reality of coaching is, when you get to a stage where you need to, where you're having a family, you're having kids, and all these things come along, the daftest little things will come up. So, like, and you might be able to speak to this more than I can. Applying for a mortgage, your credit rating, all these things, and they look at it and go, "You've had 10 jobs." That's what, and it's like, well, yeah, but I've worked at this development centre, And it's like none of the pay is the same because in some cases it's 0 hour or it's time sheeted or whatever it is. And all these things become factors that create barriers in other things outside of coaching.
Mm.
Whereas if you're, lucky is not the right word, but if you're fortunate to be in an environment where it's more, not normal, traditional, so like you're coaching in an environment that's linked to a school, so you're working 9 to 5, you're getting a regular paycheck and you're contracted, then these barriers get removed. But there's no jobs, there's all this infrastructure to facilitate the development of coaches, coaching degrees, universities, qualifications, all these sorts of things, but there's not enough jobs to supply all these people coming out with the degrees.
I'm not sure if I'd entirely agree with that. There's not enough jobs. I think there's not enough jobs that the people are trying to get.
Yeah, that's the better phrasing. So, yeah, I'm glad you pulled me up on that. There's not enough jobs for the jobs that people want, which is under 18s academy coach, lead phase, first team managers, assistant coaches. It's so tough. There's 92 clubs. There's not any more coming down the pipeline, so it's tough.
But I think just linked to that, I think one of the things that probably really helped in that space in particular is the growth of the women's game, right?
100%. 100%.
And it has opened up so many more opportunities for coaches, and especially now with some clubs investing more, growing more around the women's game, you know, the introduction of ETCs and the pro game academies and all the other stuff attached to it. you know, obviously that's not for every club. Some clubs, you know, we've heard recently a few clubs that have decided to kind of close up shop on the women's side of it, but it's opened up so many opportunities to make it more viable for people to actually go and build their careers in this space that we call football coaching, right? Albeit not being professionalized at this point in time, it is an industry that is growing. Let's just talk about that a little bit. You know, you mentioned they're currently you're working with the under 21s. Was it with Sheffield? Was it?
Yeah, Sheffield United. So youth pathway lead. So it's three different things. So head of coaching, managing the ETC, and working as a coach with the under 21s.
Wicked. So then, you know, have your experiences predominantly been in the female game? Have you transitioned across?
No. Game? So I did 3 years category three, and that was boys. 2 years category one boys. Another year category two with boys. So this is my fourth club, and this is now with females.
Wicked. So then within that, then, you know, what would you say the biggest learning points for you, and what the biggest changes or differences in between coaching boys and coaching girls? Because there'll be many people listening to this, and, you know, I guess if I go back to the origins of the podcast itself, it's very about just showing and demonstrating, highlighting the pathways and the different opportunities that exist in you know, in the world of football, more specifically around coaching, but even in wider disciplines. And I think sometimes it is just that conversation that people get exposed to, where it's like, oh, actually, I never actually thought about stepping into the women's game. And I think that's one of the challenges, linking back to what you said a few moments ago about there being effectively not enough supply for the demand, right? In terms of job roles. But with the introduction of the women's game, we're seeing a lot more roles, but there's still a lot of coaches who are a little bit on the fence around whether to move across to pursue a career and develop a career in the game, because it is not in the male game and it's in the female game, if that makes sense. So maybe just speaking from your own experiences, what that transition's been like, and what the biggest, I guess, eye-openers or takeaways have been for you in that respect.
Yeah, 100%. I think you raise a really interesting point with the female game, and it is growing, and there's more investment going in, which is very much needed. And I'll touch on that in a sec. But my advice for coaches would be, if you are only going into the female game to transition back to the male game, don't bother. And I say that because the female game needs people who are invested in the growth and development of the girls and are putting their needs and wants to the forefront and not using it as a step up or a development for the self or for selfish reasons. There is enough challenges in that environment and in that part of the industry that coaches who are coming to do that are degrading their experience, for want of a better phrase. So if you are going to work into the females game, you need to be someone who is committed to the evolution and putting the girls first. And that's not something I'd have said when I first went across. I originally went across purely because I'd finished my master's degree. My evenings were free. I was someone who would work two or three jobs coaching for years. So, like, to have evenings free was like unheard of. So I was just sat on the city, not doing anything. So the role came up, and I had a few friends that worked at the club on the male side. So I asked a few questions to see what it was like and all this sort of stuff. Said it was really good, really good setup. And one of my friends worked there, Harry. So I dropped him a message and asked him a few questions. Yep, same sort of messages. So I put my application in, and but no real. And I've worked with females before, obviously in schools and stuff, but not in a developing elite environment. So I was still, probably the best word for it is naive going into it. It was just wanting to get back on the grass and coaching on a more regular basis. But it's been such an interesting experience, and it's one that I've loved to death. I'm so glad I did it. It's just fitted my coaching style so well, and the way who I am as a person, because it is different. I can't put my finger on what the differences are, but it's just different. whether that's because of the expectations around where they need to be, the culture of girls football in comparison to the boys, or I'm not sure. Yeah. It's just a different
feel. It's an interesting one. I mean, I've had predominantly my experience working with boys, but I've had experiences working with female players and girls in particular, you know, kind of the upper YDP, PDP kind of age groups as well. And, you know, one of the things I've certainly found in my experiences of the female game is that it's not to say that anything's necessarily better or worse in the male or female game, but I think it's just the appreciation. Actually, the game is in such an early stage of its evolution, right? That I think the opportunity it gives for coaches who are trying to develop, trying to improve themselves, trying to work towards whatever it is that they're aiming towards, is that there's probably less expectation around what coaching should look like.
Yeah.
Whereas I think in the male game, in particular within academies, there's probably a perception of, yes, just because of the, you know, the times that we're in and how, I guess, like, you know, we touched on coach education has developed and evolved. There's probably varieties of what that looks like in the male game, but there's probably some clear expectations as well. So I'd say probably adjustable black lines around what coaching should and shouldn't look like. But there is black lines where I feel like in the female game, in my experience, is there's probably a little bit more gray. And it's really an opportunity for coaches to go and kind of take it as a, you know, as a canvas and play around with it a little bit. I don't know if that's the best way to describe it, but I think there's less expectation on what the coaching should look like. Therefore, the coaches have probably have a bit more freedom in that respect.
100%. I think exactly, sorry to cut across you, exactly what you said. There's a cultural expectation of what a boys' academy should be and should be producing. And the state, and you can imagine the stakes are so much higher at the boys, in that if you produce a, you help produce a player for a first team, if you're at a category one or a championship club or a Premier League club, that's millions and millions of pounds. So the pressure and the high stakes nature of it sort of constrains and demands a certain type of coaching. And then you put all the cultural stuff alongside it as well. Exactly what you're saying, that the female game, because it's so new, there is a wiggle room in a sense where there's probably still, I gotta say it, like a,
there's probably still some space to mold it a little bit, isn't
there? Yeah, exactly that. An exploration point of what should it look like for the girls, because that's one of the biggest things I'm finding is coaches trying to copy and paste, and I did this, then this is why I'm seeing it, copying and pasting what they've done in the boys' game and putting it into the girls' game and not getting the exact same thing and becoming frustrated really easily. And it's just an acknowledgement that, like, that these players are different in terms of why they're there, the motivations for being there, the thoughts and perspectives around what they should and shouldn't be doing, how they interact as groups, how they interact as individuals with coaches. Like, the difference between a male coach and a female player's interaction and a female coach and a female player's interaction is a lot different. So it's little nuances like that where you've got to start to bend and adapt your coaching to suit the players. I think that's why the point I raised before around if you're a coach in the boys' game coming to the girls' game just to get on the course or just to develop your career a bit further, why not to bother? Just because the girls need specialist female coaches. And that takes time to develop and to adapt to, and coming in and just imposing what you want to impose won't help anybody.
100%. So let's just talk about that a little bit then. You know, what's your approach? You know, what's the mold that you try and follow within the coaching? You know, where has it always been that way? You know, what's the biggest shifts in that? You know, as I'm just thinking out loud, you know, if about what I've just said there, I always remember this one conversation I had with a mate of mine. I started coaching in 2009. I think it was probably maybe 3 years on from that. Had a conversation and said, "Your coaching's really changed, yes. Your coaching's really changed from when I first saw you." And I was like, "Okay, well, what do you mean by that?
For the better or the worse?"
Well, you said it was
changed.
Yeah, it was just changed. It wasn't. It wasn't. I think better or worse is subjective, and it's dependent on the player's perception of it, right? Mm-hmm. And this is why sometimes I even challenge players in, like, you know, getting them to understand that just because you've had a bad experience with a coach, and maybe they've tried to adopt a certain philosophy or approach or style of coaching with you, doesn't mean that it's the style that was negative. It just might have been a negative experience.
Mm.
Whereas I think some coaches, you know, players, if you put yourself in the players, I just want to be told what to do. Can you just, rather than, you know, using that kind of more guided discovery and exploratory approach, which may not have been something that they've had a positive experience with. So therefore, you know, especially for young players in particular, they're probably in their minds thinking, this isn't going to work with me. I just need to be told what to do, which can also be equally true, right? But I think it's also just having that perception that, you know, don't limit yourself to your past experiences. Try and be more reflective as to understanding what that looks like. So, I mean, coming back to my own thing, you know, probably similar to what we described, like, it was stop it, get in there, coach it. A lot of command style coaching, which, again, you know, I want to make a really, really important point that command coaching isn't negative.
No, definitely
it's a perception around it. I think it's got a place, and I think it's got a lot of value if used appropriately, right? But that's with anything. And it's less so about how you do it, and more so about the impact it's having. I think it's the key for me. So, you know, maybe from your perspective, you know, what's that been like for you? You know, how did you start off? How's that shaped? And, you know, what does it look like now?
My first initial experience of being coached within the grassroots club was very much command style coaching, and very much like we did loads of running, loads of fitness stuff, and then played a game for 5 minutes at the end. So it was very militarized, is like a really strong way of saying it, but it felt like a military program, if that makes sense. So lots of running and then 5 minutes of football. So then when I got into coaching, the explicit part of coaching and the command style wasn't my initial go-to, and it's not really my personality. So I very much went down the, probably not even probably unconsciously, very much around questioning, very much around guiding discovery, very much around putting on practices that looked and felt like the game, and could flow without my input. So it was very much like, very much a facilitator in that we're in a practice that looks and feels like the game.
Mm.
One of the measures I'd have was if I walked off and fetched a ball or turned round or whatever.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Whatever that is, could the practice still run without me there? So that was very, very much my thinking for what sort of practices I used. But exactly what you're saying, the command style coaching and the explicit instruction needs to be part of your toolbox. And the moment as a coach you decide that you're not going to be a certain type of coach, so I'm not going to be a coach that's command style, or I'm not going to be a coach that asks questions, or I'm not going to be a coach that facilitates player-led interactions, is the moment you probably diminish your ability as a coach. You've got to be able to do everything. Not do everything effectively, but you've got to be able to have a toolbox of skills as a coach to be able to lean on every type of coaching. And that came through probably one of the knowledge gaps, in my Category 1 experience, where I tried to be my type of coaching. It didn't work. because the players responded more to being told what to do because of the pressures of the environment and the stakes and all these sorts of things. And that was the environment and the coaching environment. And then I tried to be that, but it came across very false. So then the impact, so the players would just see right through me because it was false. So then coming out of the master's degree and coming away with that perspective of you need to be able to do, you need to be able to lean on every type of tool in your toolbox. And so that's what I've just done. Just seen the players in front of me, really, really took a look and thought, what do the players need? Ask them loads of questions. And I don't mean in the session, this is around and before the session about how do you like to be coached? What do you want this to look like? Got their needs and then me put in the wants. So one really big point was we asked the girls, what sort of sessions do you like, do you love? Put it on the whiteboard and they wrote down what they loved. In my mind, done the university course, got my own perceptions, I'm like, love games, love practices with the where you're scoring in my goal, I'm scoring in your goal, all these sorts of stuff. All the everything they put on the board was technical practices, hate 1v1s, love technical practices, love games, but only like them when they're like small-sided, so 3v3, 4v4. So the obviously my first question, you hate 1v1s? Yeah, because everyone's watching you. Because if it's 1v1, everyone else is stood watching. Or, and then the next one, what about technical practices? Yeah, love technical practices because it gives us a really clear picture of what we want to, what achievement is and how to, and what we're going to do. And it's easy to get success. So they want that feeling of, I'm getting this right. Whereas my whole sessions before that was like 1v1s. Games,
all the stuff they don't like.
All this stuff they don't like. So
but again, right? It's a really interesting point because, you know, it goes back to what I was just saying a few moments ago. You know, just because that's your perception of it doesn't mean it's a negative thing. It might just been negative experiences with the interaction of that way of working or that type of practice or whatever it might be. But you know, I was speaking to a colleague of mine the other day, and he made a really good point that it got me thinking. Like, it was almost like, oh yeah, I'm aware of that, but I never really thought about it in a way that he did. And he mentioned that, you know, maybe it's that nowadays there's a greater emphasis on game-based activities and whatnot, because actually, and versus what maybe was 20 years ago, very technical to start with, very, you know, a large emphasis on opposed work and things like that. But maybe it's a reflection of society and the fact that, well, maybe 15, 20 years ago when you were growing up, and certainly when I was growing up, it would have been a thing where we're playing football every day. We're playing our own 1v1s. We're playing our own 3v3s and 4v4s and all those small-sided formats just in our everyday lives, right? Whether that be playing on the streets, going out to the park or whatever it is. And then maybe that's where the place is to now refine through unopposed activity around the technical aspects. Whereas now there's less play, so probably less emphasis should be placed on the refining of the technical and actually the play, so that you can learn and to understand the game, if that makes sense, which is something that probably, certainly when I was growing up, probably wasn't really the challenge. The challenge was about how do we get better at playing the game rather than how do we learn to play the game in the first place, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'd wonder if that was, and I'm thinking about the coach I had, so it might not be a fair question. Would that be the consideration for him as a coach? Or would, I think his consideration was, if the players are fit, they've got a better chance of winning. That, I think that's what he was going after. And I think, have coaches really got that global view to say, well, they're not playing any more football other than here, so we're just not just going to do games. I don't mean it like that. We're going to do games that are reflective of the demands of the game instead of going too far away from it. I would say the change and the shift has come from probably academics, people like Mark O'Sullivan and that whole ecological dynamics concept and around that representative game design and constraints-led approaches. And the, like we spoke about earlier, the next wave of coaches coming through are being taught and led through that. And I think a lot of it, a lot of the research is, and it's probably a generalization, but a lot of the research seems to be that, yeah, more things are coming out in game-based practices, more things are coming out in representative game designs against technical practices. But and it's taken a long time to get to this space. I'm conscious of the fact that the more, exactly what I said earlier, the moment you disregard any part of coaching and say, I'm never going to use it, is the moment you make your job a bit harder. Because exactly what the girl said when they were saying what practices they like, they love technical practices. I don't think I did one with them before that moment. So it was like, they need, well, they want this. It'll give them that extra little bit of motivation if they do it. So let's just throw 10 minutes in before, you know, in a session or whatever, and just try and link it and still add little bits in to make it a bit more effective. But can we make it a part of their footballing diet just to give them that extra psychological boost and to hit some motivation points?
That's a great point. You know, it goes back to, you know, one of the questions you mentioned earlier that you ask your players about what kind of sessions do they like. And I remember, I think it was around 2016, 2017, where that kind of 2 to 3 year period, I often look back and I say, well, you know, this is probably the time frame where I probably learned a lot. I learned the most, where I felt I developed the most, because at that period in particular, more than any other time, from a coaching perspective at least, I became very intentional and deliberate around all my actions and all my behaviours. And one of the things that I kind of refer back on in that time is actually, yeah, literally what you said, what kind of practices do you like? And it wasn't just leaning on that information as the holy grail and the answer to all my problems, but actually examine it further and delve into, well, what is it about that practice that you like?
Exactly.
What is it? What, you know, because if I can pick out, well, what the ingredients are that you're enjoying, then let me use those ingredients in what I'm doing.
Exactly.
And you know, it got me to a point where I'm starting to develop less practices, but practices which serve their needs and their wants, but allow me to use those practices as a platform to do the coaching that I'm trying to get across as well. So you're kind of meeting them where they're at, getting what you want out of it, getting what they want out of it. So everyone's a winner in that respect. And then I guess, you know, one of the other things to then consider within that is, you know, going back to the point between the difference between male and female players, and probably something that I kind of reflected on it in action as well. So about 2 years ago, I was working with a group of female players. In this particular instance, they were goalkeepers. And I'm someone who doesn't typically do a lot of unopposed technical work. It's not really something that I'm, again, I understand the value of it, understand the, you know, its place, but it's probably not my go-to approach. But I was faced with a bit of a challenge at one point. It made me reflect holistically around what it is that I'm observing. And it was that, okay, I'm working with these female goalkeepers, all kind of 14 to 16. And it was in particular, it was on a distribution session that we were working on. And I realized, some of these guys can't kick a ball properly. And I was scratching my head for a couple of weeks while I was just observing this over a number of sessions. And I think to myself, okay, don't really go after the unopposed and don't really coach them in an isolated technical type practice. But actually, it links back into the comment my colleague made recently around, yeah, but we used to play a lot more. But then if you think about the girls' game or female players, and this is probably a bit of a generalization, but I'm sure you've experienced this as well. A lot of female players, outside of when they're actually playing, they're not even engaged in football.
Yeah, 100%.
They're not even engaged in it. So it's not like, you know, even though it's more challenging now to find players or find people that play on a regular basis outside of the club context, you probably still do see boys go down to the local AstroTurf and get together and play, or, you know, or play football against, you know, ball and wall stuff in the back garden or whatever that might look like, right? But I don't think you really get that with female players.
Because they've got such varied interests, right?
So, well, this is it. So, you know, it posed me a real kind of dilemma from a personal standpoint. I said, "Oh, yes, you don't really do a lot of this stuff, but this might be the time."
Mm.
So then, I went from doing what was very much game based, game related, probably a lot of semi opposed kind of work to actually, we're just going to strip it right back. We're just going to go technical with this. We're going to go right back to coaching you how to kick a ball, different types of services, all the usual stuff around passing and distribution and whatnot. But then it led me to think, oh, okay, cool. So I'm looking at that situation with probably if this was 2 years ago, so about 13, 14 years experience. An understanding of how coaching has maybe shifted in terms of what is seen as effective coaching or what best practice might look like as a coach. With all these experiences, knowledge of what I've seen and what I've observed and what I've been involved in, and then insights from a coach development standpoint around what's effective, what's maybe not as effective, and what's maybe more effective. And then it got me thinking, well, okay, I can see that with all the experiences I've got, but what about a coach who's just stepping into this process?
Mm.
Someone who's maybe stepped onto the UEFA scene in the last 3 years while you've been delivering and probably doesn't have that technical grounding or that appreciation for the unopposed technical type work and maybe the level of detail that maybe needs to go into supporting players to become more effective in those actions. What chance have they got?
And that's when it, I think, links back to my previous point of the moment you disregard any sort of coaching, whether that's technical unopposed or, you know, explicit instruction, is the part you probably diminish your effectiveness, because your ability to step back and go, right, the players need this now, so this is what I need to give them. So it's being confident enough and experienced enough to see that this is what the players need and this is the thing I need to implement. And that's when, again, going back to my point right at the beginning, in your coaching, if you're an inexperienced coach, to go and coach as many different things as possible, get as many different experiences as possible, so you can train your eye in a sense of what you're looking for. And then after you've trained your eye, or as you're training your eye, to see what you need to look for and the inefficiencies, then you can start to play around with different strategies and try different things and see what works with this person and what works with that person, what works in different contexts and environments and players and motivations and genders and all these sorts of things. This is the thing about coaching. You'll never always get it right. Or get it right ever. So it's just trying these different things and see what works. What we spoke about earlier, coaching is tough in that you never get it right. You've got to try different things. Everyone's got different experiences and perspectives. There's no real blueprint to being a massively effective coach, and this is the silver bullet to be the best coach in the world. Mm. You've just got to go and do it.
You're spot on, but I think, you know, linked to that is probably, whilst there's no silver, but I think there's definitely some key things that coaches need to be effective at. And I think the one that often goes amiss is the art of noticing and observation.
Yeah,
I just being really good at that. And there's no shortcut for that. It takes time, it takes experience, and it takes repetition, right? And I remember just, again, I think it was around about 2016, I was doing my A license with a mate of mine, and he just happened to be 10 years older than me and had been coaching for 10 years longer. And I used to get so frustrated at sometimes, right? Because we'd be watching a game together and he would just see things quicker than me. And it's not that I wouldn't see them, but he'd probably, let's just say for argument's sake, he'd notice something, or he'd see like, you know, a little pattern of behavior or action, and it might take him 2 or 3 seconds to observe the pattern, where it would might take me 4 or 5 or maybe even 6 seconds to observe the same thing. So it's a subtle time difference, right? But it used to frustrate me. But then as time went on, I was like, okay, cool, I get it. You've just been doing this for longer. You've just been doing this for longer. So and it is that's the biggest challenge that I'm finding with coaches, especially at UEFA C and even delivering on the UEFA B, which is helping them understand, look, it's going to take time.
Mm.
It is just, you need to know what you're looking for, right, 100%. In order to be able to see it. And I think that's probably the biggest challenge. Or sometimes as coaches, if their things are going to plan, they don't really question why it's going to plan. But when the goal is wrong, they can't understand why it necessarily goes wrong. And you know, the question I like to challenge coaches with a little bit, and just to get them to think a little bit more and actually reflect a little bit more effectively, is you've been working with this group of players for the last 2 years. You know, you've been getting good results. There's players being moved on into higher levels or whatever. But how can you prove that it was down to your coaching?
Yeah, it's so interesting you said that. I said the same thing. So when I applied for the youth pathway lead role, one of the questions before I did my presentation to the club directors and stuff was, what are the things that you've been doing that are successful? And this was in a coaching, from a coaching perspective, what are the things that you've been doing that are successful that you wish to continue? And they had a couple bits. It was interesting because I then thought back on just my coaching as a whole, the whole journey. So what have I been doing in my coaching that has brought success to a group or a player that I want to continue in this new role? And unless, exactly what you said before, unless you're intentional and deliberate through what you're delivering and your interventions and your behaviours and your practices and all these sorts of things, it's tough to know what is successful. Because if you're not being intentional and deliberate, you're maybe just throwing things into the wind and not being clear on what them things are. So one of the things I'm implementing in the coach competency framework, which will be done, which is going to be put out this year, there are 5 coaching pillars. So the Blades coaching DNA, and one of them is intentional and deliberate in everything we do. So that's every session plan, every interaction, every intervention, everything we do. If someone from another club or a parent or whoever, if I'm coming to observe, the question is really simple of, why did you do that? What have you done that for? And what I'm expecting and what I'd like to see from the coaches is that, you know, I did this because, and there's a reason and a rationale for everything that we're doing. So then when we do get success, because we have got a lot of success as a club with players going and playing for England at youth levels, then we can look back and go, oh, it's because we did 3v3 tournaments twice a week, whatever it is, whatever the thing is. Or a better idea, because you never know 100%, but a better idea of what we've been doing and an understanding of why it might have worked.
I think it's a great point. Again, one of the things I'm careful with sometimes as coaches, and I really do, yeah, maybe this is just my approach to things, and maybe it's probably influenced by how I think of myself, and I consider myself quite a deep thinker. I think about everything, and then I think about everything I'm thinking about and why I'm thinking about everything I'm thinking about.
Right? thinking about your thinking.
That's it, man. And it's just it's an ongoing cycle. So it is, you know, and a challenge I put to coaches, some rocket league, you can have a rationale, but make sure your rationale is a rationale, not just a reason. Because if it's just a reason, you'll find anything that fits. If it's a rationale, then you've probably got evidence to support it. And I think that has been a real key thing for me in particular, around making sure that coaches have really thought things through. And it's not because I'm looking for them to do it in a certain way or them to do it and not to do it something, but just being really clear about why their approach is their approach. And having that clarity to the point where they can start to understand and actually analyze and assess themselves where the approach maybe needs a bit of tweaking as and when it does. So I think that, you know, that's been useful and effective from my perspective in terms of how it supports the coaches. But linking into, you know, let's look at coach development a little bit more. Then, you know, what,
yeah,
from your experiences, and this is a conversation and I've been having with a lot of learners recently on courses, and in particular around the role of the coach developer. Let's start with that. How would you describe the role of the coach? What is that? What does that look like to you?
I think if in my own head, whether it's right or wrong or not, I'm not sure. I see it as that Yoda figure where it's not always telling the person or the coach what's right and exactly what to do. Sometimes it's just showing them something different and changing in their perspective, or showing them a different perspective that enlightens them around a certain point of their delivery. I think one of the key things I consider in my development, coach development work, is that knowledge drives perception. So do I need to give them some knowledge to help them see different things and then give them a strategy to help implement that knowledge? So for an example, mod one of the UEFA C is around principles of play. And the key part of that day is like emphasizing penetration. So then what that day looks like is educating coaches on what the principles of play are, emphasizing what penetration is and what that looks like using videos and some offline learning. And then outside on the grass, the strategy of how you can adapt your practices and what the fundamental things that are need to be included in that practice to get penetration. And then once they've got their knowledge bases or are aware of their knowledge bases, then it's about observation. What can you see? How can you help this player penetrate? Then you can get in all the little details around receiving skills, pass selection, pass detail, all them little details. But if they can't see the principle of play, or they haven't got the knowledge base around what that principle is, then we can't get to a level, or we'll struggle to get to a level where I can help you as an individual coach get better at implementing that, if that makes sense. So there's a little bit around explicit instruction, giving some knowledge, checking for understanding around where that knowledge is, and then helping the coaches observe and see them things, and then going from there.
So 1 second, Jake. Sorry, mate, it's a little one. Just wanted a hug.
Nah, don't worry about it.
But yeah, no, I think you know, it's a really interesting point. Again, you know, just making sure that coaches have a clear understanding of that, and I think being able, you know, you talked about the principles of play. Again, I think it's another stumbling block for coaches, isn't it? And it's interesting. I was going through an exercise the other day with some B license learners, and I was just reflecting back, and I said, you know, how many of you got a really clear understanding what the principles of play are? And it's like, oh yeah, we've heard of those. Yeah, we've heard of those. So, well, they're kind of the foundation of everything you should be doing. Mm-hmm. And I know, you know, in terms of specific language, it's probably not as referenced as much in the UEFA C as much as it is the messages, if you like. But I then look back from previous years when I've delivered on the old level two and even the old level one, the principles of play are in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to see, you know, the perception in terms of like what coaching is, what coaching should look like right now, and how things have changed. Because, you know, I always go back to coaching things. You know, when I was doing my level one, my level two, my B license, there wasn't a choice to coach it how you wanted to coach it. You just had to coach it how you were told to coach it, right? But there's pros and there's cons to that. And obviously, one of the biggest pros and one of the biggest benefits that we've seen in the change of coach education over the years has been that there's more freedom for coaches. There's more, there's more freedom for coaches to express and explore what it looks like for them. But I think what it's done in turn is also created a challenge where they've actually oversighted things like the principles of play.
Yeah, there's a quote: before you learn the tricks of the trade, you better learn your trade. And the principles of play are your trade, really. It's the fundamentals.
It's the foundations, isn't it?
The foundations. I think like one of the first things we did at university on one of the modules, it was around understanding your sport, basically. And it was like, what's the key objective? What are the rules? So then what are the principles? So it's like, well, I need to score more goals than you. Then offside and ball, and all that sort of stuff. So that dictates that we've got to play the game a certain way. And then the principles of play are the things that are embedded on in every single game. So it's like, if these things are in everything, then everything you do alongside that or after that, your tactics, individual tactics, team tactics, whatever that may be, needs to be centered around these things. So, you bang on. The coaches need to understand these foundational concepts, principles, whatever you want to call them. So then it gives you an understanding of the next bit of the tactics and all the key skills and techniques and core moves and all that sort of stuff.
Sure. And then just linking it back into the previous question around the role of the coach developer. So, you know, one of the observations I've had is a lot of coaches really not having clarity or even being aware enough to understand how they would maybe utilize a coach developer. You know, you gave perception of what a coach developer might look like. It might be an older figure, someone more experienced potentially, almost certainly, but actually in reality none of that means anything if the coach developer is not being utilized, right?
One of the key parts of the course, and it's funny you say that, because this happened to me at if you compare my undergraduate to my master's, at my undergraduate the only time I ever spoke to the lecturers was when they was giving a lesson, and when I got my feedback for an assessment, so when you got your grade. And when I got into the master's, I tried to be the complete opposite of that. So I was booking in extra sessions, asking loads of questions, speaking to them before and after, asking them about their expertise, all these sorts of things. Because then people, coach developers, lecturers, teachers, they've been in the game. Well, use yourself as an example. You've been in the game for years. So imagine all the extra little bits you can get from that coach developer outside of the content they're delivering, number one. Number two, it's a great networking opportunity. And people look past that, because one of the things when you get UAFC, UAFB, UAFA, whatever, someone will ask you at some point, oh, who are your coach developers? Let's say, oh, it was Yas. Oh, I know Yas. You'll get a text at some point. Do you know Jake? What's he like? And you'll get a bit of a reference, whether that's very informal, but I'll guarantee that'll happen. So it's a massive networking opportunity. It's a massive opportunity to dip into someone's expertise and to get to squeeze a little bit more, and then to ask more questions to get more of an individual learning plan from your developer, just because they get to know you a little bit more.
I think it's so key, right? And even in the context of when you're on course, or even if you're coming out in a development visit context, that appreciation for, well, again, how do you want to use, you know, how do you want to utilize the coach developer? What do you want that support to look like? And I think, yeah, and the reason I sort of mention it is because I really want coaches to start thinking more. And if you have got the opportunity to work with a coach developer or a mentor or whatever, you know, support mechanism that you've got in place through that kind of means, how can you be more deliberate and intentional about how to maximize that opportunity? Because like you said, there's so many coaches out there attending courses. They're not even considering anything other than, I'm just here to get the award. Okay, brilliant. You're going to get, you probably get it at some point. But what are you doing while you're on it?
Yeah, exactly. I think a good friend of mine has helped me loads. He's a little bit older. And one of the things he said, when you're at university or college or whatever, every single one of you in the room is going to go after the same job. So back to his point previous, where it was like there's not enough of the jobs people want in coaching. So if I'm in a room with 20 other coaches, similar age, all doing the undergraduate degree together, we're all going after that job at Sheffield United, part-time academy coach. What's the thing that's going to separate you from the people in the room? And it's different on UAFC because they're not all going on the same journey, not all there for the same reasons, not all there for this with the same motivations. But again, going back to your point, be really intentional and deliberate about why you're there. If you are there because you just want the UAFC, fantastic, get all the modules done, sign off, brilliant. If you're there because you want to learn and get better, then really lean into your coach developer and be intentional and deliberate about how you're going to use that coach developer. Are you going to, I don't know, email them a question every week? Are you going to try and chat to them after the session? Are you going to, whatever that is, can you be really keep saying it. I'm going to be bored of saying it. You're going to be intentionally deliberate about what you're going to do, what's your strategy to maximize your time with that person.
And again, I love the phrase, because it's something I say a lot as well, you know, about being intentional and deliberate, because actually that's how you can ensure that, you know, there's a path that's being followed. There's a process that's being taken into account. There's something to reflect on, because the behaviors that you've intended to use are the behaviors that you're going to carry out, and therefore the behavior that you can then reflect on to identify whether they've been effective or ineffective, and if not, or if they have, why they have been not effective at all. Do you know what I mean? And so I think that piece is really key, and then kind of linked to that is just that, again, it's a phrase I use a lot, everything matters. The littlest details, and then it's and the analogy, and I use a lot of analogies in my coaching, and even when I'm doing coach development work, and it's talk about it all the time, that, you know, if you use a piece of art as an example, you know, someone's valued that piece of art, but if I was to come across and just put a little black dot in the middle of it, it's not going to be worth what it was a few moments ago. Do you know what I mean? Because every detail matters. There's a reason why it's been valued in that way, and there's a reason why it's been appreciated. In the same way, certain things will depreciate it. And that's what coaching is. It's just recognizing, right, where can we add value? What does it look like for the people who are receiving that value? And actually, are they perceiving it as value, or are they perceiving it as a loss? And I think that's the challenge of coach developing, and even coaching in its entirety. So I mean, that we could go on for hours and hours, I'm sure, around this stuff here. But I've got kind of two key questions I really want to ask you. You know, what's the biggest challenge you're finding currently in your coaching journey? And if you had to start your journey over again, what would be one thing you wish you knew then that you know now?
The biggest challenge I've got in my coaching is that I really quickly fall into that okay trap or good trap, where I become, or better way of describing it, like a pendulum. I'm either really high up on, I'm really good at coaching, blah, 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 blah. I can do this, I can do that. Or I can swing the other way and go, I'm the worst coach in the world. Can't even put a session together, blah, blah, blah. All these sorts of things. And the challenge I'd like, and the challenge I face on a consistent basis, is what's my strategy for when I'm feeling really high and good and feeling like, I'm the best coach in the world, blah, blah, blah. There's nothing I don't know about coaching. I've done all these qualifications, got all this experience. Fantastic. And then the other side, oh my God, I don't know anything. What am I going to do? I'm going to need to make myself busy. I need to watch this analysis. I need to watch this webinar. I need to speak to this person. I need to speak to that person. So the challenge I've got is, how can I be consistent in my, what would you call it? Self-efficacy in coaching, in that I want to be consistent in my output, in my sense of who I am as a coach and what I want to implement. That's getting better, but it's been something in my journey which has been a massive influence on how effective I've been in an environment.
And if you had to go back to the start of your journey now, knowing what you know now, what would be the one thing you wish you knew then?
I wouldn't change my journey, because I've loved it, and coaching is for want of a better phrase, is just in me, and that I love it. I absolutely love it.
Let me rephrase the question for you then. What's one thing that you know now that if you knew back then would have made your journey more impactful earlier on?
That's one thing.
Doesn't have to be one. It could be a couple of things that you're thinking together.
There's a couple of things, if that's all right. One of them would be the piece would be the piece around the industry. In the, and you put it best. There's more supply than demand, in terms of the jobs people want. So that's like in academies and stuff, and that part of the industry. So that'd be one. how competitive it is, which can be a positive and a negative, of course it can. So how competitive it is. The other one would be around the realization, really, that you are helping these people become elite athletes. That is not just helping them get better at football. That is everything around that, the mentality stuff, the habit building, the character, the way you've got to live to enter and thrive and survive in that environment is more than just 2 1-hour sessions and a game on a week. And that goes for coaches as well. And that you can't just rock up to a session or plan for 20 minutes and get to a session. And this is specific to an academy environment and a club environment, really. You can't just rock up to a session and just put a session on. Your standards need to be reflected of the places that you want the players to go. And so that's got to be lived and breathed in everything that you do whilst you're working in that environment. You've got to hold yourself. You've got to hold yourself to a higher standard. Exactly what some of the points you've made earlier fit with that really well. Pushing to see what's next, pushing yourself out of your comfort zone, being really reflective, being intentional and deliberate. Loads of things that come alongside that that help you help people become elite, which is your job. And then the other one would be, again, linking to the industry stuff and industry practice around the barriers being a coach can create in helping you build a traditional life, if that makes sense. So the mortgage application stuff, the credit score, all these little things that if you know about it, you can probably balance it off in ways. But if you don't know about it, it can be tough.
And you know, just two key words that jumped out at me or that are flashing off in my head as you were speaking. And I think the piece around developing the athlete and developing the individual is like, it's just being truly holistic in your approach to supporting that individual, both on and off the pitch, right? And then the second part is obviously just finding balance, you know, in terms of your own journey as a coach. You know, you talked earlier about what might be a perfect progression plan for a coach entering the industry now and having that kind of day-to-day career that they're in, but then doing coaching alongside that, making sure they're, you know, enriching themselves with a range of experiences so that, like you said earlier, they're not getting 20 years of the same thing, they're getting 20 years of different experiences.
100%.
Which I think is, you know, really, really valid and valuable advice for anyone listening to this is that. And I think one of the biggest challenges often there is though, Jake, and this is certainly my observations in the past 5-6 years in particular, it's that balance between right experience versus, well, this environment pays me £25 an hour. Okay, but this environment is going to keep paying you £25 an hour for the next 10 years. This environment is going to get you the opportunity to build the experiences you need to then go and get £40, £50, £60 an hour. Maybe, I don't know, you know, if you look at it through that lens, and that is sometimes a challenge. And I'm sure, you know, maybe less so on the C license, but I've certainly experienced it when I'm delivering B license courses and the coach is literally just not in any quote unquote suitable environment to get through certain pathways, right? In terms of like, if they're trying to get a B license. And, you know, I've got one, I remember one coach I was working with. He said they don't even have goals where they play. Okay, well, but then it's that trade off. Yeah, but I really enjoy the role. No one's telling you you have to give that role up, but that role ain't going to be sufficient for what you've got working for. So I think it's been, again, very clear in the planning of your journey and your progression around what environments you need to be in and around to make sure that you can effectively progress and align to that. So in essence, if you're not in the right environment, then what do you need a qualification for? If you are in that, if you are doing a certain qualification, then you need, and you want to be really good at it, then you need to put yourself in an environment you're going to allow yourself to flourish with it. So yeah, lots of stuff to think about there. Jake, any final thoughts?
Jump on that point really quick, and I can conscious of time. The best coaches I've seen in their journey see the qualifications not as the end goal, but as the part that comes with their roles. So as an example, you don't aim for the UEFA B, you aim to be an academy coach. As soon as you become or work in the environments that help you progress to be an academy coach, as soon as you become an academy coach, the UEFA B becomes an essential part of that. Do your job really well and you are really effective at being an academy coach, you might get an opportunity to get a full-time role. The A license comes alongside that. So it's not aiming for the qualification as the end point. It's aiming to have an impact in an environment, because then the qualifications will come alongside that, and they will become so much more valuable because you are doing it to help you be more impactful at your job. So you've got to be really conscious around what goals you're setting and why you're setting them. But yeah, I'm sure we could talk for loads more, because it's been such a good conversation. But
Let's definitely try and catch up for a part two. But Jake, it's been a real pleasure. There's been a lot of nuggets in there, and I'm sure anyone listening to this is going to take some value from it. So really appreciate your time, and finally happy to get it over the line as well.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I've listened to your podcast for a long while, so it's really good to be part of it. So thank you very much for that.
Awesome. Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at the Coaches Network or on Twitter at the Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.